Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac, and this month, Nativity, the pop opera, makes its return to the Miami Valley. Julia Fromholt will speak with some of the people involved in that production. But up first... Joining me by phone is Murray Horwitz. He is the Director of Development at Washington Performing Arts Society and also for a number of years has been co-host of Hanukkah Lights on NPR. Murray, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. It's great to be on and great to be at least vocally back in Southwest Ohio because, you know, I'm from Dayton.
That's right. And I want to talk about that before we talk about Hanukkah Lights. So let's talk about your Dayton connections.
Well, yeah, I grew up there. I mean, Dayton's home. We'll be back there for, well, not for Hanukkah, but for the week between Christmas and New Year's. And my mom is still there at age 95. My wife went to Colonel White High School. I went to Fairview, neither of which is still standing. But her family's back there. My family's got two brothers back there. And Dayton's home.
And what year did you graduate from Fairview?
Why are you insulting me? You know, it's really 1966, long before you were born. It's like...
No, I only ask because the 1960s group of graduates from Fairview have just put out a book of memories.
That's right.
So, and do you have your copy?
I have my copy. Thank you very much.
All right.
And we've also really done, a wonderful thing. We really got involved with the Historic Preservation Project. There were some... As it turned out, important stained glass windows in Fairview High School at the corner of Hillcrest and Philadelphia, and we managed to save them, and they're now hanging, I think, in what is a middle school, Fairview Middle School, and they were important works of art, and I think they would have been done away with by the Wreckers Ball if we hadn't sort of stepped up, and we're all very proud of that. There really is something. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. now. It's where I'm talking to you from, and there are people who live around here say, really? You're that close to your high school friends? I said, yeah, even elementary school friends. I mean, there's something I think about going to school in Dayton, and maybe it is that time, as you say, that's really kept us all very, very close.
Well, let's talk about your life here and what led you to broadcasting.
Boy, oh boy. Well, as you've already discovered, I love to hear myself talk, and radio is a good way to do that. I went to Kenyon College and graduated in 1970, and as I flatter myself to think a couple of our listeners may know, I then joined the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus as a clown, and I worked for 3 years touring the country. But at Kenyon, I had really gotten into radio as one of my major extracurricular activities and ended up managing WKCO, the station there. So that when I left the circus in 1973 and moved to New York, the first job I got was a part-time job, was writing news for WINS, the all-news station there. And so we always had something to do in radio. In 1976, I was part of a team that did satirical radio coverage that was syndicated, a bunch of underground FM stations throughout the country doing satirical coverage of the Democratic Convention in New York City in 1976. And as a comedy writer, did stuff for radio and later worked in television. I directed soap operas and did some other TV production on music shows on PBS and the like. And when I came here to Washington, we moved down here from New York, my wife and I, because she was an opera singer. Her name's Lisa Miller, and she went to conservatory in Cincinnati and then moved to New York. And while she was pursuing her career, I was pursuing mine. And after we had these kids, we came down to Washington, and I worked at the National Endowment for the Arts, but then got hired by NPR. And I was in charge of cultural programming at NPR for... a long time. All the jazz, all the classical music, all the comedy, all the car talk. I originated a show called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And in fact, one of our first on-the-road live audience shows was at the Victoria Opera House that my wife and I had helped reopen back in, I guess it was the 80s by that time. But in addition, one of the first shows I created was Hanukkah Lights, because we had a marketing director at that time who said, we need some holiday specials. And I said, maybe Susan Stamberg and I can read Hanukkah stories. And fool that I am, I thought that there were dozens of Hanukkah stories, because I knew there were a couple of stories by the great Yiddish short story writer Shalom Aleichem. Turns out there wasn't much Hanukkah literature at all. And after we had exhausted pretty much all there was after 2 or 3 years, we started commissioning stories from people like Elie Wiesel and Chaim Potok and other writers. So that's how Hanukkah Lights caught on, and we're very proud of it. It's been on the air, golly, it's well over 20 years now, I think, and I'm told is the most carried special by the NPR stations nationwide.
It's certainly well received by our audiences here, and we're going to air this special later tonight. Can we talk about some of the challenges of putting this program together each year?
Yeah, it's and in fact, this year, I'm not even sure that we've got any new stories this year. In fact, I'm not sure what the producer, Bruce Scott, has in mind, but listeners have their favorites, and so they seem not to mind, in fact, like hearing some of the same stories from time to time. So I think that's mostly what you'll hear this year. The challenge is that. The challenge is finding writers, commissioning the stories, and then editing them for broadcast, because as you well know, Jerry, you write differently for the ear than for the eye. And so you'll take a really gifted, talented prose stylist and ask her or him to write a story for radio. And Bruce has to work with them sometimes very, very hard to say, you know, people aren't going to be able to reread this paragraph. You got to write this in a different way. So I think that's one of the challenges. Bruce, by the way, is another Ohioan from up north. He's a Methodist minister's son from Cleveland. So he now knows more about, I'm sure he knows more about Hanukkah than any other Methodist minister's son in America. I think also finding the right mix of stories, because some of the stories are comic. Some of them are very, very dramatic and poignant. But I have to tell you that for Susan and me, reading the stories, I mean, it's really a joy. It's really a pleasure. I mean, of course, it's a challenge technically because, you know, you want to do a good job and you want to make sure you want to really bring those words off the page and put them in the ear of the listener in a vivid way. But that's a kick. I mean, we love doing that.
Well, I'm curious if there are some segments from past episodes that have really stayed with you.
You know what I can remember, Jerry, is a kind of vibe or a feeling. There are certain stories, obviously the way Hanukkah Lights is done is some stories Susan reads, some stories I read, and some we read together. And I love the ones that we read together where we're really hitting on all eight. And sometimes Susan will nudge me under the table, or sometimes I'll look up and wink at her. She'll wink, you know, and we know we've got the timing right and we're doing it well. There have been a couple of occasions when she has not been at all sure that she's done a good job, and she's done an incredible job. Even Bruce and I will be in the control booth saying, my God, that's wonderful. And I remember those. And there have been times, you know, to be any kind of performer, you're insecure. That goes with the territory. And there have been times when, you know, I think I haven't done my best, but it's turned out okay. But I do remember a story called The Two Menorahs, and I like that a lot because everybody grows up trying to imitate somebody else, and I grew up trying to imitate my fellow Daytonian, our fellow Daytonian, and my fellow Kenyan alumnus, Jonathan Winters. And Jonathan, as you know, does a lot of different voices. He's one of the great comedians of the 20th and 21st centuries. He's still working out in California. And Jonathan, if you listen to some of his recordings from the 1950s and 60s and 70s and even lately, I mean, he's able to do many different voices in a way that you really think it's two or three or four different actors. The only other person I've known who's really done that successfully over a long period of time was Peter Sellers. So I grew up in Dayton, you know, memorizing all of Jonathan's routines. And I remember The Two Menorahs, where I had to do two different old Jewish men. And I was glad that I was able to bring it off.
Can you give us a sample?
I don't remember how I did it, but, you know, I'll try. I mean, they were arguing over how do you do a menorah, and there was the school of Shammai and the school of great rabbi, maybe it was the school of Hillel, and one of them said that you add a light to the menorah every night until you have a full menorah, and the other one was you take away a light. You start with a full menorah and you take away a light until every night until there's only one. And, you know, I think I did one guy kind of like, but the school of Shammai is very, very, very particular on this point. And they say, no, what are you talking about? It was not the school of Shammai, it's the school of Hillel. And, you know, but this is not doing justice to Daniel Mark Epstein's wonderful story. So, I mean, that's the best I can, that's all I got on short notice.
Oh, that's great. You mentioned Jonathan Winters, and you also mentioned that you were a comedy writer. Was comedy a big part of your growing up?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, not only did I go to a now-wrecked high school, Fairview, but I went to a now-no-longer-existent elementary school, Cornell Heights. And, you know, I was the kid on the playground who was like, you know, the short, fat kid who had a funny name, Murray Horwitz. This is in the 1950s. And not any good in sports, younger than everybody else in the class. And, I mean, this is kind of doing a Freudian two-step with it. I mean, it's dime store psychology. But I think the way I managed to get friends and get noticed by my classmates was by being funny. And so I spent a lot of time in Miss Stewart's office, the principal, and I spent a lot of time sitting out in the hall because I was the class clown and got kicked out a lot. But I learned very, very early on that I was able to make people laugh, and I understood that was a good thing. You know, and my family, my parents and my brothers helped me understand that was a good thing.
I guess we've touched on it, but one of my questions was, what was it like growing up Jewish in Dayton in the 50s and 60s?
It was great because I grew up in a golden age, really, of being Jewish in America. In fact, the author Norman Podhoretz has written about this and said, you know, between the end of World War II in 1945 and the outbreak of the Six-Day War in 1967, it was great to be a Jew because there was a great deal of sympathy for Jews. People understood that anti-Semitism, which was kind of thought to be by many people okay and not a big deal, just as racism was thought to be okay and not a big deal. And by 1945, people understood that anti-Semitism meant something very, very different, and it was indeed not okay any more than any other kind of hatred or bigotry is okay. There was, in I think 1947, the Oscar-winning movie Gentleman's Agreement, which was about that kind of tacit garden variety anti-Semitism. And so I really did not experience any anti-Semitism growing up in Dayton until I got to high school, you know, where you hear the odd remark about the Jews this or the Jews that. And I have to say, it was, you know, my kids, I hope, haven't experienced any anti-Semitism at all, but I think maybe kids of their generation experienced more than I did. I mean, it was great. It was a very welcoming community. My family was especially active mildly active in the civil rights movement. I mean, my father was a physician who had his practice right on the heart of the West Side on the corner of Broadway and 3rd Street across from Orville Wright's laboratory. And he was on the board of the Congress of Racial Equality. So we always had a variety of people in the house and a variety of friends. And I never really felt any ill effects of being Jewish. I think it was a great time and a great place to grow up Jewish.
I've been speaking with Murray Horowitz. He's with the Washington Performing Arts Society and co-host of Hanukkah Lights on NPR, which we will air tonight at 6 o'clock. Murray, thanks so much for speaking with us.
What a pleasure, Jerry. You're more than welcome.
Nativity, the pop opera, makes its return to the Miami Valley December 13th through the 16th. The show is a musical retelling of the Christmas story from the angel's point of view, and all proceeds benefit A Kid Again, a local nonprofit devoted to children with life-threatening illness and their families. Several members of the Nativity cast and creative team visited Kaleidoscope earlier this week, and host Juliette Fromholt began by speaking to the show's creator, J. Todd Anderson, and Mike Teague from A Kid Again. She first asked Anderson how he began developing Nativity.
Well, many years ago, isn't that interesting how everything starts like that? Mark Cohey, the musical director, and I, we were commissioned, not really commissioned, they asked us to write a Christmas show at this church in South Dayton. This is a long time ago. And the pressure was on, and we had deadlines, and Mark and I wrote the show in a he did all the arranging, and then I wrote all the songs, and we put it down in about 2 years. And then that was about the time I was working on Fargo, believe it or not. And after I did No Country for Old Men, we decided to bring the show back on a more professional level, and that's when we decided to start really developing the show as a really good stage show. That's what we were trying to do. And that started about 4 years ago. Now here we are. We're in our fifth year, and it's really developed now. We're really happy the way it's developed. And that's just the way it came about. It's taken quite a while to develop the show. So,
and in the 5 years that the show has been going on, it has always been not only a great show, a great, you know, great music, great visuals, but it's also a show that is giving back to the community. Was that always the idea?
From the very inception, one of the writers, as we call them in contracts, was that this show had to give to the community, not to any church organization, always to the community. It had to be for sick children at Christmas time and their families who have to deal with this sort of thing at Christmas time. We were trying to bring a little hope into some people's lives. And we try our hardest to give every penny to the cause. That's what we're all about, is giving back 100%. It's always our challenge to give every penny back to the cause. And the cause, of course, this year is A Kid Again.
And so with that, I want to bring Mike Teague into the conversation. You are with A Kid Again. Tell us a little bit about what your organization does.
Yes, we actually service children with life-threatening illnesses. We have chapters in Southwest Ohio, Columbus, and Cleveland. We have 1,700 families that we service across the whole state. With about 370 here in the Dayton area. And what we do is we do destination events for the families, something to give them to look forward to. They're reoccurring. About every 6 weeks we try to do something that gives them something to look forward to get away from the doctors of visits, the diagnoses, and something just to look forward to that's fun. So I met Jay Todd through a mutual contact at the Beaver Creek Church of the Nazarene. Two of our biggest events each year are Kings Island and our holiday party. And we have our holiday party at the Beaver Creek Church of the Nazarene. And JC there said, hey, you got a show that needs to help kids with life-threatening illnesses. And I've got an organization that does that. So that's how we kind of came together.
That Nativity has just this sort of beautiful, hopeful, celebratory feeling throughout the show, and how beautiful that you guys could come together and
we just want it to be a great Christmas show. We're not talking about holiday season for some department store. We're here for a real cause at Christmas time, and that's what we dedicate. You know, I got over 50 people in this show, and we put in a lot of rehearsal time, and there's some people here can vouch because they've been in it. And we really try hard to make this I have a lot of big shoes to fill, because the movies that I've done, we've always had really quality movies that we've made that I've worked with other people. And I like this show to kind of reflect that quality, everything that I've learned. You know, the more you learn, the less you know. That's the way it works.
Absolutely. Tell me, Jay Todd, about the decision to tell the story from the angel's perspective. You see the Nativity story told in a lot of different ways, but I feel like this is, at least in the stories I've seen, kind of a unique perspective that you're using to tell the story.
Well, if you read the text, you'll find out that a lot of the text comes from the angel, Gabriel, who Al Holbrook plays Gabriel. And so I don't think they've ever told it from the point of view of the angel, because a lot of movies are always told from some abstract point of view, and that's what makes them kind of interesting. And it's a great story. It's been around for a long time. And I got to tell you, man, every time I see one of those plastic figures in somebody's yard all lit up, I slow down and kind of look at it. Especially in January, they're wilting in the sun. There's just something about those little plastic figures that really get me off. And then how many people can say they haven't remembered when they saw Grandma's mantle with the, you know, it's a very, very classic image. You know, in the movie business, if you light anybody low, they look sinister. They always look evil. But I think the nativity scene is the only thing that in our culture gets lit very low in somebody's front yard and looks right. Figure that one out. Pretty odd thing. I've noticed that. We're lighting our show to look like somebody's front yard.
Was that kind of maybe even unconsciously part of the inspiration for the visuals? Because I know that the angels, the characters of the angels have become kind of iconically associated with this show.
They're all in there. We made up the mime because we need an extra stagehand because we haven't got any money. And then we have an innkeeper who's a bonehead, and he throws pregnant Mary and Joseph out on the street. You got to love that. And then we have the ultimate bad guy, Herod, who's ultimately paranoid all the time. There is a lot to images, especially in the show. Although it's not a movie, we still do a lot of screen direction in this. And it's a story. We try to tell a story, and there's not much dialogue. It's all opera. It's all pop opera. So.
And Mike, what's it been like for you getting to partner with Nativity and you know, knowing that this group of, you know, 50 people who are artists and musicians, working out in the community are coming together to help benefit the kids who your organization helps.
You know, really, the thing that amazes me most every day when I come to work with is it's mostly volunteer based, and the amount of time that people put in that aren't paid staff to make a little bit of hope and fun for these kids to come together. It's the best part of my day to see that go in, and then see the smiles on the kids' faces whenever we have an event, and the smiles on mom and dad's face that says, you know, that's the only thing my kid has looked forward to for the last 6 weeks is to come out to an event that's coming up. So.
WISO's Juliet Frumholt speaking with J. Todd Anderson and Mike Teague about Nativity, the pop opera. It's running December 13th through the 16th at the Beaver Creek Church of Nazarene. To hear an extended version of this interview, including a live version of one of the songs from the show, visit our website, wiso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of early winter. When I first read the journals of the naturalist Henry David Thoreau, I wanted him to tell me more about himself. I thought that all of his notes on the thickness of ice at Walden Pond or about the dates that the asters bloomed were frivolous. I wanted him to talk just once about his most secret passions. I wanted him to stop hiding behind nature. Then I started keeping my own notebook, and I found that my personal history of the year was much more important to me than the other kinds of history that I'd encountered. Starting from an old assumption that the course of the seasons can be a metaphor for the span of life, I saw that closer observation of that metaphor revealed parallels I hadn't thought about before. Each entry of my notebook, the times of cardinal song, the measurements of leaves, the dates of blossom and petal fall, not only contributed to my understanding of a grand design, but gave me insights into all the minor, isolated actions that I used to feel were meaningless in the cycle of my life. And the more closely I looked at what was happening in the woods near my house, the more detailed and the more myopic the notes became, the more I understood the extent of the metaphor, and the better I started to understand myself, my own most secret passions, and Thoreau's passions, too. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of early winter. In the meantime, if you watch what's going on around you, you may see yourself.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wiso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Oil and gas drilling companies in the state have been in the spotlight this week. Governor Kasich raised concerns about these companies bringing out-of-state workers to fill jobs. Karen Kassler joins me. She's the State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
To what extent is this happening in Ohio?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think anybody knows. This is something, though, that Governor Kasich has talked about since he took office, this idea that the oil and gas industry, the oil and natural gas drilling industry in Ohio is going great, and he wants Ohioans to benefit from it. He's joked a couple of times about not wanting to see foreigners on these oil and natural gas wells. By foreigners, he means people from West Virginia and Indiana and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And, you know, that's gotten a few laughs, but now he says he's heard reports that that's actually what's happening, that these oil and gas companies are coming in and they're bringing their own workers, they're bringing out-of-state workers in and not offering up those jobs to Ohioans. So the governor thinks that Ohioans are missing out on these jobs. And what this very well may be, too, is another attempt to talk about the severance tax that he wants to raise on oil and natural gas drillers.
So what are the oil and gas companies saying about these charges?
Well, they're saying, first of all, that the industry is doing so well, has invested so much money, $3 billion in the state, that they need to move quickly. They need to start the process, need to get in very quickly, and that the workers in Ohio just don't have the training that workers in other states that have seen more drilling have. And so they're bringing in workers now because those are the people that they need, and they need to get them from wherever they can get them. And they also say, the drillers say, that they're drilling activity is actually sparking business and economic activity in Ohio because Ohioans are now building restaurants and hotels and other businesses that are supporting the drillers. So the drilling industry says they are indirectly benefiting Ohio's economy, if not employing as many Ohioans as the governor wants to see. They're certainly sparking business and economic activity in that part of the state.
So how big of a problem is this for Governor Kasich?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think he knows. He said in his discussion about this earlier in the week that he hasn't seen any itemized reports or anything that specifically points to this. We don't yet know exactly how many people are involved here, but certainly the concern is happening at the governor's office. He's speaking publicly about it, and so he believes it's a problem, and he wants to actually investigate it and try to find out what are the numbers, how many people are involved. And the oil and gas drilling industry is now saying, hey, the state should be happy with what is happening with economic activity and not be talking about investigating the industry to try to find out how many people are working there from out of state versus how many people were hired in Ohio.
You mentioned a severance tax that the governor wants to impose on these oil and gas companies. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Well, there's not a whole lot to talk about with that right now. The governor had wanted to do that for a while. He wanted to use the revenue from that increased severance tax on oil and natural gas drillers to offset a state income tax cut that he wants to put out for all Ohioans. And, of course, the drilling industry does not want to see that tax go up. And there are a lot of Republican lawmakers who also don't want to see that tax go up. And so this tax has been dead for quite a while, but the governor has been quietly working on resurrecting it and trying to get something moving forward on it. And so when he made this announcement, of all things, at an event where he was honoring the Ohio State University football team for going undefeated, he made this announcement about the workers from out of state working on oil and natural gas wells. It suggests that he wants to resurrect this conversation, wants to get back into this debate over whether the severance tax should go up. He certainly wants to see it go up. And this idea that non-Ohioans are taking jobs and wages that Ohioans should get, that certainly suggests that he wants to talk about how the oil and natural gas industry is going to rectify that and make things better for Ohioans.
It seems curious. Doesn't that contradict sort of that Republican Party line to impose taxes on big companies? Aren't these the folks that are going to be creating jobs?
Well, I think, first of all, Governor Kasich has been absolutely adamant in his desire to see the state income tax cut or eliminated is his overall goal. And so I think he thought this would be a great way to do that because the severance tax that Ohio drillers pay is a lot lower than what is paid in other states. And so I think he thought this was an easy deal. And I can remember when he proposed it in the summer and proposed it, you know, in a press conference. And within a couple of hours, there were some Republican lawmakers who said, no, we don't want to do that. And so I think the pushback has been a little bit of a surprise to the governor, but that doesn't mean he's given up on it.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a great weekend.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.